Welcome to Kingston Reid's Word to the Wise podcast series for HR and safety professionals.
Hello, I'm Alice DeBoos.
And I'm Lucy Shanahan.
And in today's podcast, we're going to talk about bringing it all to the end. Is it really the end? Complicated issues about when an employment contract or the relationship of employment actually comes to an end. Lucy, what on earth am I talking about?
You are talking about a recent decision of the full court of the Federal Court, which talked about a particular phrase, the ordinary and customary turnover of labour, and what that means about an employment relationship ending. But we also might talk about two other terms too, and that is a person who's engaged for a specified task or engaged for a specified period of time.
Because they often get confused, don't they?
They certainly do. They certainly do.
Yeah. When we talk about these phrases, why do we spend so much time on them? Why is the court continually looking at these phrases?
Because what they do is they provide employers with a way to actually engage a workforce rather than just an individual employee in a manner that has implications for what the employee may be entitled to when the employment ends. And that's both in terms of the entitlement to a redundancy payment if the employment is terminated by way of redundancy, but also the employee's right to make an unfair dismissal claim. So it's really important that employers get it right, because if they want to rely on those exceptions, then they need to get it right.
Okay, so you started off by mentioning that today we're going to talk about two distinct phrases as they appear in the Fair Work Act. The first is the ordinary and customary turnover of labour, and the second is looking at when an employee might be engaged for a specific task or engaged for a specific period of time. Why is the distinction between these two phrases important?
So the phrase ordinary and customary turnover of labour is actually, well, firstly, they're found in two separate sections of the Act. So you need to understand where in the Act they're actually found to understand why they are important. So the phrase ordinary and customary turnover of labour is found in section 119(1)(a) of the Act. And section 119, of course, establishes the entitlement to redundancy pay. Yep. And we know that an employee is entitled to redundancy if their employment is terminated at the employer's initiative, because the employer no longer requires the job done by the employee to be done by anyone. That's fairly commonly known. But section 119(1)(a) also contains this exception, which is...
The exception to having to pay for redundancy.
That's yep. right. And that's where the employment terminates at the employer's initiative, but that decision is due to the ordinary and customary turnover of labour.
Okay, and then what about specified period of time and specified task? Because it might arise in the same scenario, but it might not.
That's exactly right. And a specified period of time and a specified task are also relevant to a person's entitlement to redundancy.
Right.
But they're also relevant to a person's or an employee's entitlement to make an unfair dismissal claim. So relevantly, for the purposes of redundancy, an employee who is employed for a specified period of time or a specified task is not actually covered by the scope of the division of the Fair Work Act that deals with an employee's right to redundancy.
Okay, so that's part of the NES.
That's
so
right.
Someone who is employed for a specified period of time or for a specified task is actually excluded from that bit of the NES.
That's right.
Okay. Yeah. And the other element, of course, is that employees who are employed for a specified period of time and a specified task quite separately are not entitled to bring an unfair dismissal claim.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. And that's why we find them arising in lots and lots of court decisions, because there are these two different applications of these concepts.
Yeah. And I think because they're quite technical terms, like, you really need to look into them to understand how they actually apply. And they have been defined quite narrowly by the commission and various courts. So it's really important to understand that the technical aspects of them. But because people don't spend a lot of time looking at that, it is easy to get them confused and to use them incorrectly.
Yeah, and almost interchangeably too.
That's right.
Quite often.
Yeah.
So let's start with ordinary and customary turnover of labour. This is not a new phrase, is it? This is a phrase that's been around in labour law for donkey's years. It's been examined up and down by just about every court in the land, including the High Court of Australia. And it's a phrase that in more recent court decisions, really the judges are looking at, very importantly, the termination, change and redundancy cases. That examined what a redundancy is and situations that will give rise to redundancy entitlements. And then relevantly now, from the 1st of January 2010, when for the first time ever a general statutory right to redundancy pay was inserted into the Fair Work Act for all employees. And from that date, this old phrase of ordinary and customary turnover of labour was also inserted into the Act to really reflect all of that case law and reasoning that had been built up over many decades.
Yeah.
So do you want to explain in basic terms what the court in this recent case has actually decided?
Yeah, sure. So this case, which was handed down last week by the full bench of the Federal Court, is a case that's been going for a couple of years, and it arises from a scenario where essentially labour hire engages employees to perform cleaning services, essentially, and they do it in accordance with the terms
or a series of cleaning businesses are engaged on contracts.
That's right. Yeah. To perform the services for contracts that go often for a period of years. So they may be a 2, 3, or 4 year contract, and at the end of that period the contract is renewed. And that has gone on for a period in some cases of 15 or 20 years until it didn't anymore. The decision was made to tender for the contract, and the service provider didn't win the tender and therefore didn't have a contract, so didn't have to provide the services, and made the decision to terminate the employment of those employees who had been engaged to provide the services. Now, in that case, they didn't make a payment of redundancy because they argued that those employees had been terminated in the ordinary and customary turnover of labour.
Yeah. Reasoning that it was a business. I don't actually think we said the name of the case. Berkeley Challenge and United Voice. Reasoning that it was a business that was dependent upon the continuation of particular contracts to particular customers. And when those contracts come to an end, the reasoning of the employer was that those employees must naturally have their employment relationship come to an end as well.
Because there's no more work to perform.
That's right.
Now, the full court of the Federal Court found against that submission, and essentially has said that that phrase, ordinary and customary turnover of labour, really defines a termination where the employer no longer requires the job to be performed because the termination in that particular case is common or usual. So that's both in the sense that it's commonly observed, or it's a habitual or long-standing practice.
It's almost like thinking about the phrase custom and practice that we use quite often in industrial relations disputes, for example.
That's right.
And the court, I found in the judgment, gave some very useful observations. And again, I don't think they're new, but I think it was set out in a way that helps reinforce these principles and give some really sound examples. But the court set out that whether or not there is an ordinary or customary turnover of labour will depend on the facts of a particular case.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
Judges always say that. But at the end of the day, there will still be a few common factors that were relevant. The first one is, what were the employees' expectations? So what was their objective expectation?
Yeah.
And the way that you work that out is you look at what were the discussions during the recruitment process. So that gives rise to looking at what were the terms of the contract that was offered, how was the employment advertised, in order to work out what the expectations of the employee. So did the employee, at the time that he or she entered into that contract, think that it would be common or usual or normal for this employment to come to an end at the end of that particular contract, for example, which I think is a really, really useful way to look at it. What were some other ones?
Some other ones were whether or not the turnover of labour that is being relied upon to justify the use of the phrase ordinary and customary turnover of labour is an inherent feature of the nature of that particular kind of business, rather than something that is implemented by a business to try and remove an entitlement to the payment.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. This is not about the employer's business.
No.
The court made it very clear that this is not about how the employer views its business plan or the way that it structures its business or its contracts. It's actually an objective test about what the nature of the work is and what perhaps the nature of the industry might be. So I thought that was a really, really interesting observation made by the court.
And you can imagine that, I mean, in this case, the employees, there was no evidence that the employees had any expectations that their employment would come to an end at the end of the contract. It wasn't in the contracts, it wasn't a discussion. Similarly, though, this is an industry where this is a common feature that the work requires contracts. But the difficulty here...
This is an industry where, just to be clear for the listeners, is that where you will be doing the cleaning contract for a particular building or a shopping centre or some other type of facility. So the nature of it is based on contracts that run for a period of time.
Yeah. But where that contract is well, frequently, insofar as a contract that's 4 years long can be frequently renewed, that, of course, becomes more difficult to argue that it's an inherent fact, you know, an inherent feature in the nature of that business that the employment ends. Because actually the other argument is that it's an inherent feature that contract is simply renewed.
Yeah, or even if it's not renewed, that there's an inherent insecurity about working in an industry that's based on client contracts.
Yeah.
And so many industries out there are based on the successful procurement of our contract to provide that work. But that does not mean that... there is a habitual or long-standing practice to turn over labour in accordance with those contracts.
That's right, which there needs to be.
I think another one that the court looked at is whether or not it's evident from the nature of the work or the type of business activity being conducted or the nature of the job itself that the work would come to an end even though the business would be ongoing. And I think an example of what the court's saying there is there something about the work that these people are performing? Is it seasonal?
Yeah.
Is it harvest-based?
Yeah.
Is it event-based, such that it is blindingly obvious that it has to come to an end because there's a task or an event or a time frame during which this work can be performed and then it has to come to
an
end.
Then it comes to an end,
A cleaning contract is not such an event.
No, that's exactly right. The last factor that the court really identified was considering whether or not the actual event of the termination itself is unusual. And the court did refer to specific examples to say this is not ordinary and customary turnover of labour. And the examples were where there is a permanent closure of a business or where, you know, a shop or a business terminates that or closes because of the end of a lease. In those circumstances, that is not considered ordinary or customary turnover of labour. That would generally give rise to an entitlement to a redundancy situation.
Yeah. But it's important to remember too that doesn't mean that the employee's employment can't come to an end when a contract finishes. It simply means that they're not excluded from a redundancy payment.
That's right.
The other important factor, and I think we'll deal with this at the end of the conversation, won't we, about you can't change this fact simply by changing your contractual terms.
No.
And that goes back to the fact that the court made it clear that this isn't about the employer's business practice or the way that they structure their workforce. This is an objective test about the reality of the work that's being performed.
Yeah, that's right, which is why...
And whether or not there's that habitual and long-standing practice that can be established.
And that's why you really need to think about these things at the outset and deal with them at the very beginning of the relationship.
Yeah. So that's ordinary and customary turnover of labour. Let's then move to when is an employee engaged for a specified task or a specified period? Because I always hear these concepts talked about interchangeably, even though they're separate.
They are separate, that's true. They actually refer to two different things. So if we look at firstly a specified task, so as Alice said, that's a phrase that is used interchangeably with the specified period of time. But a specified task is quite different, and the Fair Work Commission has defined this phrase really narrowly. So if you want to rely on this exception, you need to be really specific on the terms of your contract that you're actually seeking to enforce to argue that.
And it's quite an argument that it's been narrowed over more recent years.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Definitely, yeah. So the commission, the full bench of the commission has said that the specified task must be identified in definite terms. So you need to be able to look at a contract and you need to effectively see the task in express terms in the body of the contract. Then there, it has to be clear, it has to be predictable. It shouldn't be something that you go, well, maybe that's what it is.
Supposed to be
that's
doing.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. So when I said it had been really narrowed, that's what I mean. That's how specific it actually is.
Yeah. And really importantly, because this gets confused all the time, a task is not a role.
That's right.
It's incredibly common in the construction industry, or in fact any construction, infrastructure and resources projects where you do often engage people for a project. This type of discussion and these types of concepts come up all the time. And in fact, there's a great illustrative case called Dale and Hatch where the employee in this case was employed by an engineering consultancy, and she was employed as a site and facilities administration lead on a contract. The engagement terms were said to be for a fixed term basis to provide support on a particular project, and that the contract would terminate on her demobilisation from that particular project. But the contract referred to a position. It didn't specify her task. There is no such thing as a task as a site and facilities administration lead.
No, that's right.
That's a job that involves a number of tasks.
That's right.
A task, for example, would be where a contract said, you are employed to produce a report on the engineering requirements of stage 3 of XYZ project.
Yeah. That's exactly right.
Because that is a task. Mm. It is a task which is readily defined. It's clear and predictable. And the end of the employment can readily be seen from the completion of the task.
Yeah, that's right.
Generally speaking, the full bench of the commission said that a task, if you're employed to do a particular task, then it's a task that you would have to complete.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're not actually employed to do that particular task.
That's right.
So in that case, I think I like that case because they're contracts that I see all the time. And in that case, the full bench does go into a nice discussion about the difference between a task and a role. So if you are employing an employee for a particular specified task, and I have to say this is really uncommon, but it does happen.
It does, yeah.
Then you need to describe that task, and you need to describe that task separately from the role.
It's actually more common that we see people seeking to rely upon that exception. And then when you look at the terms of the contract, you think, you can't actually do it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Because it's really unusual to say to someone, I am engaging you for this task. That's quite unusual.
Yes.
It's more usual to say, I'm going to give you this role and here's a list of tasks I'd like you to do.
Yeah.
And I'd like you to do them over this time period. But not necessarily just perform that particular task.
Yeah.
But that exception to unfair dismissal and that exception to the part of the NES dealing with redundancy does require that task to be performed, even if it's you are employed to paint these three houses.
Yeah.
It has to be as clear and as definite as that.
That's right. It's more common, isn't it, Alice, that we see a contract that is for a fixed term or a specified period of time?
Absolutely. If I had a dollar for every time someone said, I've got this fixed term contract, but it wasn't a fixed term contract. It was a maximum term contract. I would be a hell of a lot richer than I am today. So at the outset, before we go any further talking about specified period of time, there is a distinct difference between a fixed term contract and a maximum term contract. A fixed term contract is one that is for a fixed period of time and it cannot be terminated prior to that fixed period of time for any other reason other than usually misconduct. But there certainly can't be terminated on notice, frustration, all of those kind of things. A maximum term contract, which is far more common, does specify an expiry date but allows the employer and the employee to terminate the contract with notice during the life of that contract.
And that distinction is really important because if you want to rely upon the specified period of time exception and your contract that you're seeking to use to rely upon that exception is a maximum term, then you may have difficulties actually relying upon that contract to get you into the exception.
Yeah, and the full bench only a couple of years ago in a case called Kayam and Navitas English really did redefine and narrow the test in relation to this. And in that case, the full bench said that where there is an outer limit in a contract by a date, but there is an unqualified right for either party to terminate the contract during the life of that contract, then that is not employment for a specified period. And by unqualified right to terminate, what we mean is your basic notice clause, which says either party may terminate this contract on 1 month's notice, full stop. That's an unqualified right to terminate.
And the reason it's not a contract for a specified period of time is because the termination date is not certain. So even though there may be a termination date actually in the contract, because either party can terminate the contract on the provision of notice, there is actually no certainty about that end date.
Yeah. So this case involved something which would be very familiar to many listeners across a broad range of industries. It was a gentleman who was employed for quite a long period, but on a series of
1 or 2 year
maximum term contracts, which were renewed on a regular basis to continue for another 1 or 2 years. At the end of his last contract of employment, a decision was made not to offer him a further contract on the basis of concerns about his performance. And the employer said that there was no termination at the initiative of the employer because the contract terminated with the passage of time.
Yeah.
Okay, so here we're dealing with the exception to unfair dismissal law.
Yes.
But if he did get up on that argument and it was a contract for a specified period of time, he would also not be entitled to redundancy pay.
That's
so
right.
That's back to that interrelationship between the two. In order to meet those requirements, an employee's got to be employed under a contract of employment for a specified period of time, but also their employment has to terminate at the end of that period.
Yeah. That's right. The only exception to the rule, and this was a matter that was dealt with by the full bench in this Navitas decision, is if the contract contains what we refer to as a qualified right to terminate the contract.
That's right.
So that would be a term which says that the employer can terminate the contract in limited circumstances.
Yeah.
So, for example, on the basis of misconduct.
Breach of
contract.
As long as you make then poor performance, if you make good performance a term of the contract, then you could certainly have a termination clause which said that the parties don't have the right in an unqualified manner to terminate the contract. However, for the following breaches, termination
can
occur.
Right.
That is a really important exception, Lucy, because that's not normally the way that you would draft a termination clause ever. We would tell you not to do that. But if you do want to have a maximum term contract, you do want to rely on that for the exclusion to redundancy pay and rely on that for the exclusion to unfair dismissal, then the drafting of that termination clause does have to change from the normal.
Absolutely. And of course, you have to be really careful about ensuring you comply with those terms as well.
Yeah. I mean,
it's not enough to have the contract there in these great terms if you're not actually going to comply with it.
Yeah, yeah. And the second part of that test that I mentioned is really important as well, because that gets overlooked and is the subject of a heap of cases, is that the employment has to actually come to an end because of the end of the specified period.
Yeah.
You can't get rid of someone because you don't think they're very good at their job.
That's right.
That's a different reason for bringing it to an end. It has to genuinely come to an end
because of the effluxion of time.
Yeah,
that's right. So that also means that you actually need to make sure that your administrative processes are in place such that there's an awareness that the contract is coming to an end, so it's not allowed to just roll over, which can sometimes occur.
Yeah, yeah. So how do we wrap that up into what do you need to take away and what do you need to think about from our chat this afternoon?
Well, the first thing is that the Act makes it really, really clear that you can't rely upon these provisions to get out of an entitlement or a benefit that is provided by the Act. So if you're going to use these types of contracts, you have to have a legitimate reason for doing so. And trying to get out of paying your employees a severance payment is not a legitimate reason for doing so.
Yeah, and you can't make it up, right?
No.
A lot of the time we say, when we talk about employment law issues, we say, well, you could fix this by a proper contractual term. You can't do that here with the ordinary and customary turnover of labour.
No, you can't do it retrospectively.
No, that's right. You can't, essentially, as they say, you can't put a bridle on a pig and call it a horse.
That's right.
In order to rely on ordinary and customary turnover of labour, you really have to have those objective circumstances right, and have this as something that is a custom and practice in your industry, but also something that is driven by the particularity of the task or the business that you're in.
That's right. And that should be part of the discussion from the outset. So, you know, if you can frame an advertisement, if you're looking for staff in a particular way, when you're engaging or recruiting, you have the discussions about the employment being related to the term of the contract and the fact that there is no promise of ongoing employment once the contract terminates.
Yeah.
And ensuring
that over time we could create this.
Absolutely.
Over time we can turn the pig into a horse, but it will take some time to establish that custom and practice.
And then
making
sure that that's also reflected in your contract as well is really important.
Yeah. A huge takeaway is that, you know, if the employment is genuinely for a specified task, make sure that the task is really clearly identifiable.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Because I can't say that I regularly see that.
No.
I see employment contracts for a role, not for a task.
And it is difficult because it requires an employer to plan and to spend time. And again, even if you have a contract for a specified task, if that person is asked to or the position develops into other tasks, then arguably that goes against the contract being for that specified task too.
But maybe you don't want to just employ them for the specified task. So don't get wound up in trying to extricate yourself from redundancy pay and unfair dismissal by trying to make it for one task when in fact it's not. Don't worry about it.
That's right.
Just make the employment contract for the role. Deal with redundancy pay and try and avoid unfair dismissal claims. Really what I'm trying to say is that you shouldn't try and shoehorn situations to avoid either a redundancy entitlement or an unfair dismissal claim. Because there are other ways to deal with those issues. Run your business.
Run your business the way you need to run your business in the best possible way. And if you can use these different tools correctly, then you make sure you set it up right, but don't look at it the other way around.
I think that you should also really be aware of the impact of any changes that might occur during the employment period. So you might forego your right to rely on one of these exceptions because of conduct that occurs along the way.
That's
an important thing to take note of as well.
That's exactly right.
Any other last thoughts?
Well, we didn't touch on the making sure if you're going to rely upon a contract for a specified time that it is truly for a specified time.
Now that's a good idea.
And by that I mean, you know, the contract goes from the 1st of January to the 31st of December and put a year on the end of either of them. But if you are going to have a termination provision in there, which will then call into question whether or not you can rely upon that exception, think about whether or not you are prepared to have it qualified, because that will assist you, but it also does limit your ability to terminate.
It limits your ability to terminate. And again, is trying to avoid a redundancy payment worth limiting your ability to terminate? In my view, most of the time the answer is going to be no. Because if someone's only been employed for a short period of time, your redundancy liability is quite small in any event. And an unfettered or unqualified right to terminate for any reason, subject to unlawfulness, of course, is a very valuable right to have.
That's right.
An employee should be able to terminate the contract as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
You don't want someone working for you locked into a contract who doesn't want to be there.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. So thank you for tuning in today. I really hope that at least some of what we've said has been useful. Please have a look wherever you, if you enjoyed our podcast, please have a look wherever you find your podcasts, whether that be for iPhone or Android. We're under Word for the Wise, Kingston Reid, both in Spotify and in the podcast app for Apple phones. You can subscribe and then, of course, you'll be notified whenever we upload a new podcast. But that's all we have for today. So thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening.